Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian podcast that will never, ever, ever chase you into a bathroom stall, at least not without your consent. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi, friends.
Hey, Matt.
Howdy.
I do think all...
Happy Monday.
All bathrooms should be pay toilets, Matt Welch. Just want to put that out there.
Yes. Operated by John Waters. This is
sure.
This is revealed truth. We're going to talk about, speaking of pay toilets, we're going to talk about the status of various trillion-dollar pieces of legislation here in a moment. But first, is data privacy a thing of the past? I'm British now. No, sirree, Robert, it is not. Introducing Secure, the instant messaging and email platform hosted in Switzerland. By using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from various intrusive governments and laws. Featuring 100% homegrown technology, zero affiliation with big tech giants such as Amazon, Google, or Microsoft, Secure is the choice for privacy enthusiasts worldwide. Make the move to Secure by visiting Secure.com. That is SEKUR.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. So last week on this podcast, we talked about how it was finally Infrastructure Week and that long-awaited trillion-dollar bill was tethered to another long-awaited, even more trillion-dollars bill, both of which were expected to be addressed and maybe even passed last week. This week, we're going to talk about apparently the same thing, but with exciting new updates, including perhaps some shade thrown at various politics and journalisms. Suderman, do you want to lead us off by telling us where the hell we are in negotiations? And by we, I mean about seven people.
So, you know, I think it's probably useful to take a step back and think about this in the context of the 1974 Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act. I'm kidding.
I'm actually kidding.
You got me. I was like, oh, no.
So the short version here is the $3.5 trillion bill is no longer a $3.5 trillion bill. It's something less than that and probably less than $2 trillion, maybe even as little as $1.5 trillion. And the reason for that is that there aren't 50 plus one votes in the Senate. The Democrats just don't have the votes to pass a $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. And so all of the talk going into this year about how the real problem was that we have a filibuster and Republicans who are, you know, who are obstructing everything and it's all anti-democratic. No, the problem is they don't actually have a majority in the upper chamber to pass these things. And it's not even 100% clear that they have a majority in the House, which, again, they control because the margins there are so slim, and even a couple of defections would mean that they can't pass the bill. So this is, of course, enraging the progressive side of the Democratic Party right now. They are particularly mad at Joe Manchin, who wrote, who put out one of these statements last week that, you know, basically just said, $3.5 trillion is a lot of money. The debt is real. We got a big deficit and inflation seems to be a thing. And of course, those are like trigger words for the AOC, Jay Appel, Bernie Sanders caucus, who don't think that debt matters at all, who think that inflation is modest and not really a concern right now, and who basically think they own not only the Democratic Party, but all of Congress and the White House right now, and therefore should have a right to just ram through whatever they want. And so it has led us to a point where Bernie Sanders, who again is one of these guys who's been like, we must save democracy. You do a much better impression Look. Than I do. Yeah, right? But like, we have to have the democracies and we have to save them. And he actually tweeted something to the effect last week of two senators should not be allowed to stop what 48 senators want to do.
Like that's
it
the
is
whole
a
point.
Democracy
yeah.
after all.
Yeah, it's not two senators because he's referring to Manchin and also Kyrsten Sinema. Who is the other Democrat in the Senate who is really out front and saying, I'm not in favor of the $3.5 trillion bill. But it's 52. It is a majority of the Senate is not willing to pass this thing. And so this is democracy working here. We will probably end up with a bill probably in the range of $1.5 to $2 trillion. But it's not going to be a $3.5 trillion bill because the votes just aren't there.
Speaking of Catherine's gal pal, If my Twitter feed was real life over the weekend, and it is, then the most important news events concerning these trillion-dollar pieces of legislation was basically a protester or protesters chasing the Arizona senator into a bathroom stall. So, Catherine, are you willing to tone police such behavior? And would you care to reflect on Kyrsten Sinema's role in the ongoing negotiations and political imaginations of humanity?
I absolutely am willing to tone police. In fact, for Halloween, I'm going to be sexy tone police. Because that is an important role in our society and democracy.
Wait. I think we need to defund the tone police.
Defund the tone police. Oh, my God.
That's been accomplished.
Yeah. So the
story. We need more social workers in toilets.
That's true. So, tonal social workers. Okay.
Atonal.
We're okay, everybody. Keep it together.
Atonal social workers.
So, yes, we are not talking about what we might spend these trillions of dollars on, whether it be 1.5 or 3.5 or 4.2 or whatever it is. That time for that conversation is past. We are now only talking about meta things about this bill. And this weekend's meta thing was this unfortunate incident in which a senator into a bathroom, and she did a thing which you could see the video, and it's like, I think it's what I would do too, which is she was washing her hands. She really was kind of done, and the video was there, and they were harassing her, and she just went back in the stall and closed the door.
She pulled a Larry Craig.
Which is, oh, no, she didn't. How dare you?
Well, we don't know if there might have been somebody else in there with her. I don't know.
But
I think she pulled a Billy Ray Valentine, but go on.
I don't know who that is. The thing that incident highlighted for me was that it is a bad idea to do every goddamn thing in one bill. Because Kyrsten Sinema is not bad on immigration. She is moderate on it, as she is moderate on many things. But she was a co-sponsor of the Dream Act. She has been very clear that she supports a path to citizenship for people like the person who was following her into the bathroom, as far as I can tell. Obviously, the details of this person's immigration status I'm not privy to, but she is not bad on immigration. She has strong views about spending and debt and deficit, and this bill is doing freaking everything. And so, of course, some people's priorities are going to get downplayed. And, you know, the idea that her voting against this bill shows she doesn't care about immigrants, which was essentially the claim here, that she promised immigrants to stick up for them and now won't. You know, it's just like a perfect illustration of why we should, I don't know, consider making individual laws using the lawmaking process that Congress has available to it instead of lumping it all together and then doing a fight to the death.
You know, like the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act of 1974 calls
for. Bite your tongue.
Stop it. Nick, speaking of the freaking everything aspect of this bill, you know, as you especially talked about last week, trillion-dollar spending bills are kind of momentous acts of federal governance and changing of the way the federal government has a relationship with its citizenry. Yet when I was scanning just this morning for headlines on Google News, on the Drudge Report, on the Twitter news tag, on the New York Times, stuff was buried. Could not find it on the first and sometimes second go through on the front pages of these things. To what, if anything, do you attribute this seeming news disinterest? And does it tell us anything about politics and journalism as of 2021?
I don't know, Matt. I'm sorry. You flustered me with that. I mean, I think, you know, for me, there's two takeaways. One is that, you know, it took forever to break the 4-minute mile in track. And then once it was done, it became kind of common. Or Matt, to use a baseball analogy, it was really hard to beat, you know, Roger Maris's 61 homers seemed like, you know, that was out of reach. And then suddenly it got beat, and it got beat a bunch. And now $1 trillion bills, which used to be a big deal, are commonplace. That's like the ante to get into the game. And I think that's deeply disturbing. It is kind of balanced by the fact that people are worried about debt, and polls consistently show that. I think on a very kind of primal level, people understand that if the government keeps spending more and more, it's not actually going to pay for it. It's going to borrow for it. And that over time, having a budget that is, you know, 100%, 200%, 1,000% of what your economy is just not a good thing to do over time. So that's kind of nice. The news media isn't talking about it because the news media seems to be largely legacy media, mainstream media, whatever you want to call it, seems to be in favor of spending more. And it seems to me they're very upset that the Democrats were not able to push this through despite having a working majority where they could have done it through, you know, various things like reconciliation.
Beginning last week or so, started seeing all this red-faced sputtering among some blue check journalists on Twitter because the phrase debt ceiling was being just used in sentences. And it was just like, oh no, not this lie again. Like there's eyes just popping out of skulls. Sutterman.
Wow.
I will kill him.
I cannot control what comes out of this.
It's okay, Matt Walsh. I forgive you.
Ooh, ouch. Yep.
I you know what? Deserved. Yep. leaving aside for a moment, although I'm sure you'll work it in, the perfidy among the Republican Party about the debt ceiling beginning when they retook the Senate in 2014. But it's still kind of at least somewhat popular among the public, right, to say, you know what, the debt ceilings shouldn't just be rubber stamped. Their expansion should not just be rubber stamped. Like, it's weird, is it not? This is a dislocation between general public opinion about this thing and what has happened to kind of elite political class opinion.
Well, the public cares about debt and deficits. And that is one thing that polls have shown. And in fact, quite consistently over the years. On the other hand, if you ask the public what we should cut in order to deal with debt and deficits, you don't get answers that make a whole lot of sense. The most popular thing always for at least 20 years now is that we should cut foreign aid. Now, look, sure, let's cut foreign aid. On the other hand, if we eliminated all foreign aid, it's maybe in a big year, 1% of the budget. It basically has no long-term effect on the debt or the deficit. If you want to make a long-term effect on the debt or the deficit, you have to cut entitlement spending. Or maybe you have to reduce debt service or cut military spending. But it's really entitlements are the long-term drivers of growing debt and deficits. And the public does, in fact, like the entitlements, Medicare in particular, Social Security in particular, old age entitlements are popular, and people do not like politicians who say they're going to cut them. That is an unpopular stance. And so there is, I would say, if you want to sort of treat the public as a single mind, which is in some sense a mistake, but is a thing you kind of have to do when you're talking about how the public views things, there is a disconnect there. I would also say there is some misunderstandings about what the debt limit is versus the debt and deficit itself. So the deficit is the annual gap between spending and revenue. The debt is the total amount that the federal government or the public owes. And the debt limit is how much the Treasury is allowed to pay. And so raising the debt limit does not actually increase the amount of debt you have. It simply authorizes the Treasury to make the payments on the debt that we have, on the borrowing we have already done. And so even if we spent absolutely nothing else, if Joe Biden came out and got agreement from every single Democrat and they all went on record and said, our new plan is spend no additional money, only the money we already have planned to spend. There's no new spending legislation. You would still have to raise the debt limit in the short term in order to meet America's fiscal obligations. That is not an answer that's super popular amongst libertarians. But again, it's a thing where people are sort of confused about that. The other thing, though, that I would bring up just on the topic of spending and on the, you know, sort of while we're here, is that as part of this discourse, as part of the discussion around the $3.5 trillion bill and the way that it's now being whittled down, what is really amazing is that whittling down of hypothetical spending, so that $3.5 trillion, that has not passed in legislation in both the House and the Senate and been signed by the president. It's not real yet, right? It's still being debated. And like I said, it's probably going to end up being less. And because it is probably going to end up being less, it is being portrayed by progressives as cuts. And so they are saying
literally killing teachers.
Right. So they're now saying we're cutting trillions of dollars of spending, despite what we're doing is we're actually adding only a smaller number of trillions. And so that is being portrayed as cuts. And so on virtually every side of the budget discussion, there is just insane language being used to describe what is actually happening, which is that we are talking about either spending an awful lot of money or way, way more than that.
I think, you'll see whenever whatever passes, Republicans will say, you know, well, look at us, we saved you $1.5 trillion, et cetera. So, I mean, this is from a libertarian point of view.
Republicans will end up treating those as cuts too, even though.
This is the logic of Washington.
All of Congress is like, I say this with the deepest love and respect, my mom at TJ Maxx. Like, all of Congress is just out here being like, we saved more than we spent. The spending wasn't real. Here's the price. And then there's the fake price. And then there's the price we paid. It's like, it's still spending. It's just still so much spending.
At least at TJ Maxx, Catherine, you get the maximum for the minimum. Whereas...
I love TJ Maxx. I'm not a hater, but I think the other thing about this whole debt limit conversation is I generally am not annoyed by like elites talking down. Like, I am an elite who talks down, so it's just I just identify with it. But
just to me, though.
I mean, really to everyone in my life. But last week's conversation, which was like, you idiots, the $3.5 trillion is actually zero. Why can't you understand that? And then this week's conversation, which is the conversation about the debt ceiling, is actually totally irrelevant because that money is already spent. Like, yes, that is true. That is an accurate, unlike the $3.5 trillion is actually zero conversation, that is much more true. But it wasn't an act of nature that money got spent. Like, Congress chose to spend that money. A normal order of operations, which the American public might be forgiven for believing is how business is done, is like, we see if we can get the money. We see if we can afford the thing. And then we vote on whether or not to spend the money on the thing. And then we do the thing. And that is so very much not how Congress works, but it's how Congress should work. And I think that, you know, this notion that like the foolish American public just doesn't get what's going on. It's like, yeah, because what's going on is bananas.
I think one way to look at this somewhat positively is the failure of the Democratic Party, which again could have done whatever it wanted in terms of the infrastructure bill and the $3.5 trillion, you know, whoopee cushion. The fact that they were not able to, I think, is a sign that this moment of expansive unlimited spending, which was ushered in under Trump, you know, where we saw the budget go up massively and hit, you know, $6 trillion. That moment is coming to an end. And I've long felt that Congress and special interests or just interests have been stuffing, you know, the pinata because they know it's going to break at some point. This is a bad metaphor already, but they want to have as much of their candy in there when it cracks open and showers down on the children, but not the Mexican children, maybe dreamers. I don't know. In any case, this moment where it seemed as if you could propose anything and get it into a spending bill somewhere is coming to a close. So that might be good. And then the real work begins, which is to, you know, kind of undo at least 20 years worth of unbelievably profligate spending and actually start addressing the entitlements that Peter mentioned before that are constantly in the state of being expanded. And that is a big part of the progressive agenda to expand Medicare and Medicaid to include everybody, to include dental and vision care for everybody everywhere at all times. That's the battle going forward.
I want to cap this part of the discussion by just mentioning in passing a couple of pieces of choice hyperbole. One is in a rock magazine called Rolling Stone, an article.
I thought it was about Dwayne Johnson there for a moment.
Yeah, I also heard that rock. I don't know what's wrong with me.
This is rock magazine here. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin just cooked the planet. I don't mean that in a metaphorical sense, he says. I mean that literally.
Wow.
Unless Manchin changes his negotiating position dramatically in the near future, he will be remembered as the man who, when the moment of decision came, chose to condemn virtually every living creature on Earth to a hellish future of suffering, hardship, and death. That's mm-hmm. the lead on a mm-hmm. Rolling Stone magazine. So I think what that means is that they're just going straight into black metal. Nick, is that what we're going with?
Wow.
It's no
David Cassidy has a cold, right?
The other thing is that Suderman just mentioned the Congresswoman Jaya Powell, who I think really would be getting so much more of kind of derision and mockery if only her name was as cute as AOC, because she says a lot of crazy stuff. She's the one who's the progenitor of childcare is infrastructure. Deodorant is infrastructure. Like, she just does that every single day. And like the debasement of the language, I think, is worthy of mockery and also eventually maybe kind of string pushing on those who are doing the debasing. I want to extend the conversation. Wow.
The string pushing debasers.
Saw them open for fear.
They opened up for the Pixies, yeah. Right? Yeah. We're going to talk more about infrastructure in a moment, if I can pronounce any of these words.
Infrastructure. Infrastructure.
In a moment. But first, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, and stuff like that? You can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. BetterHelp.com, H-E-L-P, like what I need pronouncing anything, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month, with other financial aid also available despite BetterHelp's low prices to begin with. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/Roundtable. I got that one. Describe your issues and your preferred technological methods of delivery. They'll get you someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that person, you can swap him or her out. Please visit BetterHelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right. This is going to be our email of the week, slightly early. Remember to keep them coming to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Raphael, who can be found on Twitter. Remember, you can always say, like, hey, I tweet at this weird address and I will read it out. In this case, the weird address is war damn n tweet, or like war damn, like meaning I damn war tweet. Anyways, Raphael, he writes, I get that trains aren't the most efficient way of getting around and require massive tax hikes, eminent domain, etc., but I still want them. How do I reconcile that with being a libertarian? The best cities in the world have subways, light rails, and trains, so why can't we get them in places besides New York City? The neighborhoods that people actually want to live in and are therefore the most expensive are walkable and have subways. Eliminating parking minimums can help, but that won't actually get subways built. Seems like a catch-22. They get used in places with high density, but can't easily or cheaply be expanded there. But if we try to master plan a new walkable community, no eminent domain or billion-dollar project has to happen. But those places don't need them since they aren't dense, and most libertarians would tell you it's a waste of money. Catherine, answer poor Raphael's quandary. And if you don't get Robert Poole in the answer in your first paragraph, you're fired.
Absolutely was going straight to the Bob Poole, so no worries there. Lots of libertarians love trains. I think if I had to speculate, and this is what's going to get me canceled later in my life, it is because of the autism spectrum that both people who love trains and libertarians have in common. But I don't have strong evidence for that. It's just a theory. No, trains are super cool. I love me some Acela time because, again, coastal elite, but also because that is one of the very few trains in this whole freaking country that makes any sense at all, both from a financial and logistical standpoint. But my real answer to this, what I feel like is the underlying question here, is like, probably we're going to have to do with transportation at this point the same thing that we did with the post office, which is that like libertarians are going to write and think and talk a lot about how the basically state-sponsored version of the thing sucks and needs to be reformed or privatized or something. And then something else is going to happen that's going to make the whole conversation irrelevant. And maybe it's flying cars, and maybe it's jetpacks, and maybe it's Elon Musk's like super tube or whatever the thing is called underground.
Hyperloop.
Yep, super tube. And maybe it's charter cities where we all like go to Honduras and a private entity builds the perfect subway. Can you build subways in Honduras? I'm not clear on the ground conditions there.
Monorails.
But, like there are
need
ways.
A soil sample.
There are ways to imagine a future of transit and transportation that meets all of your desires, dear letter writer, that isn't quite trains in the train enthusiast Bob Poole's three-car garage full of model trains kind of way. And I hope that gives you like enough to be going on with.
But Catherine talked about the future. I will just mention briefly the past, which is that at the very beginning, the New York subway system was run by two privately owned companies. And currently in Florida, there is a privately run intercity rail system, rail line, I should say, between Miami and West Palm Beach. It's a company called Brightline, and they are building track up to Orlando right now, which just suggests that although I would not say that it is incredibly easy and the conditions are not always like perfectly great for building private rail, they have happened before, and it's not completely impossible.
I would challenge the premise of the question, which is that, you know, the cities where people like and use and are willing to pay for subways or light rail systems that are always heavily subsidized exist. And it's just that they cost a lot of money, like New York and Washington, D.C. in the United States, Chicago to some degree, Philadelphia to a lesser degree. And when you try to put these, light rail, it always sounds like a good idea. I've lived either in or adjacent to a bunch of smaller cities such as Buffalo and Cincinnati that had something like this, Cleveland, and the fact is nobody uses them. Even the homeless don't use the light rail in Cleveland and Buffalo, which you would expect them to, right? So that it's one of these things where people are like, God, you know what would be great is if every time I wanted to go from my comfortable house somewhere to the big city to a specific destination point, wouldn't it be great if I had a cheap and ubiquitous and heavily scheduled rail line where I just walk on, get out at the stadium, get loaded, and then stumble back into the subway and sober up on the way to the, you know, to my house? Wouldn't that be great? It doesn't work that way because of economies of scale. And so, you know, it's kind of like it would be nice, you know, when I was a kid, I thought it would be nice if we lived in colonial cities with cobblestone streets and, you know, knee pants and tri-corner hats. It's a good fantasy. But to the extent that it works, it's already in places like Paris, London, New York, Tokyo, all super expensive cities. And to the extent that it doesn't, it's also in a bunch of smaller mid-sized cities that people are fleeing because it doesn't work.
One way to look at the question is that libertarians and Bob Poole in particular are fond of not only acknowledging their own fondnesses or lack thereof for various things that exist in the world. And I totally have a fondness for subways. I was enthusiastic about the existence of subways in Los Angeles, for example. And then you can have that on one side, and the other side, you can have their acknowledgement that there is such a thing as a cost-benefit analysis. And there's no reason not to subject your inherent kind of aesthetic preferences to a cost-benefit analysis. And when you do that, you see, oh, New York is unusually dense, just preternaturally dense, and also has an unusual amount of stable bedrock. it's great to build subways in this place. It makes so much sense to do that. And so that's great. And then if you're in a place like Los Angeles, which is famously very spread out, and there isn't such a discernible flow of human beings between this area and that area, it kind of flows all over the place. You do the cost-benefit analysis. Also, there's earthquakes you might have heard of. And you go, oh, yeah, the thing that we want to do if you want to move more people around is have a lot more buses. And here's the thing. People never have an aesthetic preference for a lot more buses because at heart, they are indulging in their own fantasies of either building something, ribbon cutting something, or just they had a really great time on that Eurail pass when they were 24 years old in Europe. And that is no way to make public policy in the United States and America. So you can have subways in places that make sense. And you can also acknowledge in places, many places, most places in which it does not and do not succumb to the temptation of building high-speed rail between, you know, Fresno and Bakersfield just because you had some aesthetic preference out there.
Do you think that the Beatles killed bus travel with Magical Mystery Tour, Matt Welch?
I think that's fair to say, yes.
I mean, nobody wanted to be on a motor coach ever again.
I mean, the Magic Bus also kind of screwed things up for everybody involved. Yeah. But anyways,
if not for those Eurorail passes, we wouldn't have had the movie Before Sunset or the whole trilogy.
Then it was all worth it.
The other thing about like high speed rail between Paris and Lyon, which I take all the time to echo Catherine's point, that's what people love to point at. Like, hey, why can't we get a TGV everywhere? Well, the TGV is between Paris and Lyon, which people go back and forth all the time, and it's all on flat ground, and it was like farmland, and you could just zip. It made a lot of sense, and even then, it's still kind of subsidized. Yeah, that's how.
Wait, how do you ride the train in France?
Zip, just like that. All right, let's go to COVID and vaccine mandates. Which are, it's a little gendered, for being honest. California Governor Gavin Newsom Friday announced plans to add the COVID vaccine to the list of regularly scheduled vaccinations required to attend school in person. That is, when the vaccine receives full approval from the Food and Drug Administration for middle and high school grades. That would make California the first state to do that once it goes into effect. Important note about this order, it would only go into effect during the start of the term after it gets approved. So if it gets approved, like, I don't know, now, then it will be the following semester in which that would get approved. That's different than the existing school vaccine mandates that we see in first in Culver City, California, second in the Los Angeles Unified School District, and then most recently in San Diego, which adopted it for 16 years and older last week. And we're already seeing widespread student vaccination requirements for student athletes in various high schools. So, Catherine, you are soft on school vaccine mandates. Do you think that it is generally a good idea for schools to require in-person vaccinations on populations that thus far have overwhelmingly not been very vulnerable to this terrible disease?
Right. So I think there are two questions. The first question is, can schools mandate vaccination as a general matter, right? Leaving aside the COVID vaccine for a minute. And as a country, we have like overwhelmingly already answered that question, yes. I would like to see lots of reforms to the ways that we do schooling, including not having, you know, truancy laws, having more school choice, having school choice be more expansive, et cetera, which I think would soften the burden of those requirements on people who do have concerns about vaccination. I think those people are wrong and that they should get vaccines. They should get all the vaccines, stick your children with needles, love to stab my children. But the COVID vaccination question is interesting because, for one thing, it's still not approved for young children. Like, it's all hypothetical on some level. Also, we have, I think, very good evidence at this point that this is simply not a very risky disease for children. So this is not about protecting children, which is what most childhood vaccinations are about. You know, you really, really, really don't want your infant to get mumps. But it's about protecting the teachers. And I think that does change things a little bit. It changes the math. That said, this has never struck me as a libertarian hill to die on. You know, this is just something that people like this debate is long over. And I think came to a consensus that is fine by me. You know, that said, yeah, I think there's a bunch of legitimate questions about whether, you know, kids who are unvaccinated right now seem to be about as safe from serious cases of COVID, from hospitalization from COVID, as adults who are vaccinated, even older adults who are vaccinated. This is not a disease that poses tremendous risks to young children. And that should be factored in the decision. Also, we already have lots of problems with inequality in schooling. We also have some notable demographic characteristics of people who are hesitant about vaccination. Do you think we could like maybe really, really exacerbate those by further alienating, I don't know, authority skeptical Black families from the public schooling system? That'll probably go great. So there are concerns like that as well to think about.
Let's build on that last point, Nick, and just zero in on the second largest school district in the country, the LA Unified School District, whose population shrunk by 10% over the last 2 years.
And is home to at least $1 billion school building that is mostly empty. That was built in the last decade.
Had several feet of subway for that.
That's true, yeah. Or, you know, like a billion iPads or something.
In the late...
The LA Unified School District did pay for and then promptly lost.
Late 1990s, LA Unified went on a school building binge that was routinely described as the largest public works project west of the Big Dig in Boston. And I can testify, having covered all that stuff, including a little bit for reason, I think, that like there was... almost zero kind of public comment about like, should we be doing this? Is it all right to bulldoze all these houses for a declining school district? Anywho, Nick Gillespie, LAUSD made this change after the school year started and made it effective pretty darn soon. I think December is when it comes in, and it's for 12-year-olds and up. Given, and you know, LAUSD, which already tests everybody in the system, vaccination or no, once a week. The testing rate is about 0.25% positivity, and obviously masked up the wazoo. Do you think the LA Unified's vax mandate for kids is a good idea? And if you don't, how do you retort to the Gavin Newsom and otherwise Californian line of like, hey, this is why it's so low. We're building back better here in the Golden State.
I think that kind of extending what Catherine was talking about, I think that there are a limited number of places where a vaccine mandate makes sense in society. And I think it's also something that we should think about from a libertarian point of view. If you have something like a smallpox, which, you know, by most estimates has something like a 30% infection fatality rate versus something like COVID, which has a sub 1% vaccination rate. And that type of, you know, shift in magnitude really has to factor in, unless you are a pure apodictic certitude, you know, Misesian or, you know, Randian or something. The actual, you know, effects of something should be part of a debate over whether or not a policy becomes mandatory. You know, with mumps, measles, and rubella, these are not diseases that generally kill people or kill school kids. But there is a good, you know, argument to have that be a condition of going to school, which most states have with fairly robust exceptions, ironically, except in places that are super red, like West Virginia and Mississippi, which are very hard to allow exemptions for your kid being vaccinated. But there are other school mandatory school vaccines that are kind of questionable. Hepatitis B is a good example. It is something that you're only going to get if you're indulging or engaging in risky behavior that most children, certainly kids in kindergarten through, you know, sixth grade, are not indulging in. There's an argument that that should not be a part of a mandatory vaccine list and things like that. And I think COVID in a lot of ways falls into that because of, as you were harping on, Matt, you know, it's not a particular threat to kids. They don't get it. They don't spread it very much. Teachers should probably be vaccinated. And it's fascinating that in all of these discussions, you know, we focus a lot on what kids should have to do. And it would seem that literally the literal adults in the room, maybe we should be talking about them more, because they were the ones who were bitching and moaning. Teachers, you know, over the past 18 months were saying things like, we need to get vaccinated first in front of old people who are specifically at risk. Otherwise, we're not coming back to school. They got bumped to the front of the line, and then they were like, yeah, we're still not coming back, you know, and they kept, you know, suing for more and more stuff. I would like to see more, you know, kind of attention paid to that. And then the other thing that I will point out, because I think this is worth thinking about, is that every major new vaccine comes, people are relatively slow to take it up. And I'm looking at something that Gallup put together. When polio vaccines first became a possibility in 1954, polio was a disease that didn't necessarily kill people, but it maimed a lot, especially young people. In the early days of it, 31% said they would not take it until it had been around longer. The Asian flu in 1957, 20% said they would not take a vaccine. There was a new smallpox vaccine introduced in 2002, 35% said they wouldn't take it. Swine flu in 2009, 42% said they wouldn't take it. And COVID in 2020, 35% of people said they wouldn't take a vaccine. This was before they came online. That rate has come down. Vaccine hesitancy comes down as people get used to the idea. And while I am super pro-vaccine, I want to take every vaccine I can. I steal them from the lunch bags that Catherine packs for her kids. I take the extra vaccines and just stab myself with them. But we have to respect the fact that there's a social learning curve whenever it comes to new vaccines and new diseases. And we need to be respectful of that, even if we think people who are vaccine hesitant are just flat out wrong.
On the learning curve point, I actually think it's just worth highlighting the conflicting messages here, because on the one hand, the state of California, which, you know, is a big state with lots of people and lots of influence, even if only indirect, over how other states and sometimes the federal government make policy. The state of California says your kids have to have the vaccine in order to go to school. And then on the other hand, the FDA, the federal government, says, wait, your kids literally cannot have it because we don't know yet if it's safe. But also, we're pretty confident that eventually we're going to say it's safe. We're basically certain that we're going to say that eventually, but right now, we're definitely not saying it's safe. And so it's like, make up your mind. No wonder this stuff is controversial. No wonder there is lack of trust and confusion. The mixed messages that are coming from our political and public health authorities are just absolutely impossible for people to parse in a lot of ways.
Catherine, Peter's favorite person, Scott Gottlieb, former FDA commish, had a Twitter thread over the weekend, keying on an appearance that he made on one of his ubiquitous weekend chat show things, where he talked about, like, we need to think through the possible unintended consequences about vaccine mandates of all varieties. Workplace, government making it on the workplace, government against government, on
dating apps,
government employees, dating apps. Thank you very much. And that, like, you might build up, for example, you just sort of might politicize these things, like make it more of a political issue. There's close to a dozen states that have banned having, they're all red states, banned having vaccine mandates for schools, K through 12 or college. So it's kind of going in the other direction. And some of those states, even, I believe Ohio was one of them, is like, well, maybe we should take a look at that mumps vaccine. I don't know why I went to Norm McDonald. Oh, mumps over there, vaccine. So can you walk us through kind of your potential worries about unintended consequences of the heavy hand of vaccine mandates?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that I know that Gottlieb has actually been pretty consistent, but it does strike me in October of 2021 to be like, huh, should we worry about the unintended consequences of an overly harsh public health measure? It's like, oh, my friends, we are a little late to this party. Because I think, you know, the other thing that happened this weekend, right, was Fauci saying You know, I may consider allowing you to maybe consider gathering together at Christmas. And
but he's not sure.
But he's not sure. And, you know, I was actually really struck, my reaction to that, even as someone who's baseline quite skeptical of the public health establishment, like, it didn't even occur to me for one second to give one single fuck about what Fauci thought about what I should do at Christmas. And I did give like a couple of fucks like a year and a half ago about what Fauci said, because it mattered to so many other people at the very least, right? Like to sort of be able to say, hey, let's try to have a, I don't know, a play date with our children who turn out not to be very vulnerable to this disease. And Fauci says we're allowed to X. And I don't think I'm alone in thinking like this does not, this no longer influences my behavior. And I think that is the biggest unintended consequence. Like, yes, there's politicization. Yes, there's going to be bad federalism fights ahead of us on this question. But like most important of all is there quite rightly should be no feeling that we have a federal public health establishment that can be trusted in times of emergency to provide guidance. And God forbid it should turn out that something worse is still ahead of us. We have burnt every bit of capital that these people had to help Americans through a disaster.
We haven't burnt it. They have.
And, they have.
And that's
they
actually
have.
Worth just
yeah, yeah. No, that's true.
Underlining.
It is not the media's fault. It is not the right-wingers' fault. It is absolutely the fault of the public health authorities, first and foremost. Yeah, I think we can talk, again, secondarily. There's lots of weird downstream stuff going on. But the CDC and the FDA and associated humans really, really screwed up. And that is the biggest unintended consequence is like we are now rudderless from a federal perspective if something worse goes wrong.
Nick,
I do think that Fauci has just improved the market share for Hanukkah and Kwanzaa this year.
Yes.
That'll be the elaborate loophole. Beyond that, I think it's worth pointing out that this was politicized. I totally agree that public health authorities at every level, from the, you know, the local, from the block watch all the way to the federal government, have screwed up so tremendously, and they bear the brunt of it. But it's also true that, you know, Donald Trump went out of his way to politicize vaccines. And he is now at a point where he tries to take credit for Operation Warp Speed and at rallies gets shouted down when he has anything good to say about vaccines, because he curried and kind of gave cover to people who were not anti-vaccine mandate, but are actually anti-vaccine. And that's problematic. Both the Republicans and the Democrats have taken this as a wedge issue, and I think it's shifting out of anything related to some kind of underlying science, underlying social well-being and things like that. And it is merely because Donald Trump, what seemed to be against the vaccines that he helped, you know, create through Operation Warp Speed, Democrats will be for it and vice versa. And you could see this if Trump had been, you know what, I love these vaccines here, I'm getting them right now. And he's, you know, being acupunctured with, you know, with COVID needles in December. Democrats would be against them because people like Kamala Harris and a number of other high profile people were saying in the fall of 2020 that there's no fucking way I'm taking a Trump endorsed vaccine. So it's bad on politicians as well as public health people.
I think it's important both to fling rhetorical poo in the direction of right wing media lunacy, skepticism, that it's not skeptical, it's just weird about the vaccine efficacy. And also, and I don't mean to say this is equal, but it exists in the world. There's an elite journalism aspect of absolutely, I think, at almost every instance, overrating the importance of non-pharmaceutical interventions in affecting what happens to the virus as a means of moralizing and especially negatively moralizing the public policy of politicians they don't like, and all of that I think contributes to this daisy chain of eroded trust, right? Daisy chain, that's something you do with speakers, Suderman.
Well, certainly you can do that with effects pedals that you're buying along with your new electric guitars during the late pandemic era.
Thank you very much for feeling my pain. Let's, speaking of pain.
I'm feeling your fuzz box is what I'm feeling.
Oh, no, thank you.
You're giving me a wobble.
Just don't.
Also,
I'm
no,
not even
going
to say, there's such an obvious joke, but that's how much I value Fred Young, is that I'm not going to say.
You're
going to
put
joke.
That on delay there?
Yeah. At any rate, we are going to transition into our end of podcast, what we have been consuming. I want Nick to start because I want him to tell us about how he consumed Catherine Mangu Ward on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher.
Yeah, I did watch that. That was a great episode. And Catherine, I think, represented the libertarian point of view extremely well in a venue that reaches a lot of people who are not necessarily friendly to libertarian ideas. So kudos
before
to you, Catherine.
Before you go on, Nick, Catherine, this is your maiden voyage. A, how fun or nerve-wracking was it? And then B, what was the level of weird junior high school classmate you haven't heard from 25 years who got in touch with you afterwards?
Really high. Got some very high quality ones of those. Really got a second cousin, to be specific. Yeah. And it was great. It was genuinely fun. There's a very different experience when you do kind of Fox News. They put you in a little box with the Capitol behind you and you talk into an empty void for 5 minutes versus the Maher thing, which is like an audience, and it's all very, Aaron Sorkin-y walk and talk through the catwalks, backstage. Just the whole experience was awesome. And I was very, very delighted to get to tell jokes a little bit on HBO while also urging people to make new libertarian friends. So that's always my goal.
Nice work. All right, Nick, go ahead.
So I watched a large chunk of the 180 episodes of Seinfeld that have been put up on Netflix.
Oh my God. What edible was your choice during this?
Oh, you don't need drugs to watch Seinfeld. Seinfeld is the drug. But a couple of minor points about it. One is that, and this is something I've always held to, it takes until about partway through the third season for the show not just to become good or great, but really to be watchable. Like a lot of sitcoms, it really kind of sucks at the beginning. I would say The Simpsons is very similar to this. If you go back now and watch the early Simpsons, post Tracy Ullman, but after that, it's just not a very good show. And it's, it becomes something great. Seinfeld, I think, became the definitive genre-busting sitcom. Obviously, the late 90s had a tremendous amount of incredible TV, and drama is a different thing. Documentary is a different thing, but in terms of comedy. And the best episodes of Seinfeld are just tremendous, where they set up a series of kind of interrelated dominoes that fall. And in the last 3 minutes when the show is just working absolutely fantastically, it still sets the standard for, basic 30-minute sitcom format. One of the things that is a kind of cultural thing, because of course everything is politicized, everything is generationalized, et cetera. There was a great, hilarious, pathetic piece, and at NPR about whether or not Seinfeld will find the type of Friends audience that Netflix had. And because I was talking about this with a couple of other people who were Gen X and boomers, and who all of us grew up watching Seinfeld when it was on, and you would wait for that episode. It was appointment viewing TV. It is a relentlessly mean, funny show. It's not about nothing. It's not nihilistic per se, but the sheer joy of very good friends taking so much delight in each other's misfortune. It is a kind of place where you can go to just be a horrible human being in 30-minute chunks. And I find that younger people tend not to even like that as a psychic escape valve, as, a kind of inverse panic room where you can just go and kind of really delight in the misery, not of strangers, but of your closest, most important friends. And
so it's a kind
I think
of anti-Ted Lasso.
It's Ted Lasso can go fuck himself. You know? Wow. And obviously, Seinfeld gave rise to Curb Your Enthusiasm, which in a certain level is its purest distillation because, you know, it can curse. It can become incredibly dark. But I actually think Seinfeld is a better show. But that's what I was watching. And it's going to be interesting to see if, say, millennials or Gen Zers or whatever, if they discover it and maybe it will help them learn to deal with the horrible world that they are inheriting from boomers.
My 13-year-old has tore through Friends with the enthusiasm yeah. Of a novel coronavirus through populations has will never be interested in Seinfeld. I can unless it's like college and something else happens.
Yeah, I mean that's the other thing because I saw with my kids at first when they were and they're born in 93 and 2001. Early on, they didn't like it at all, and then once basically a couple years after puberty hit, or they claimed puberty hit. They really got into it. So it might just be that it is it's a late adolescence, early and middle age, then late adulthood show.
This window into Gillespieism has been particularly disturbing. I just want to lay down that marker. Suderman, what have you been consuming?
So I watched the new movie, The Guilty, which is out last weekend, streaming on Netflix. It's directed by Antoine Fuqua, who some of you may know as the guy behind The Equalizer and The Training Day. It's from a script by Nick Pizzolatto, who you may know as the writer behind HBO's True Detective. And it stars Jake Gyllenhaal. It's basically a one-man show. He plays a police officer who has been disciplined. We don't know why, although we find out over the course of the movie. And he's been assigned to work a 9/11 call center, spends most of the film alone in front of some computer screens, right? So this movie was shot in November of last year during the pandemic and before vaccines were really available. And so the director actually directed it from a van filled with monitors, and he was never in the room with the actor. It's this sort of one-man show pandemic movie. It's very nervy, very tense. He gets a series of calls where he tracks a woman who he believes has been abducted, and then things proceed from there. There are various revelations. It's not a message movie. It's definitely a thriller that just works on its own terms. But if you look closely, you can see that it's a movie about the ways that the state has failed people. And it has failed to provide for their needs, whether that's mental health or policing. You see failures in the court system, even amongst the police officers themselves. At nearly every stage of this movie, there is a breakdown of social services. And so it's an interesting movie to watch as a libertarian, because like I said, this is not a movie that's like trying to hit you over the head with a message at all. It's just a super tense, super nervy thriller that happens to be about the ways that that our complex of public services don't work well together and kind of fail the actual individuals who they are supposed to be serving.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
On my flight to LA to be on Bill Maher, I watched really a large amount of Bill Maher. And I do want to commend to the audience, if you haven't seen the episode where Michael Moynihan is on with Donna Brazile, please watch it. It is the wildest hour of TV in like a pretty delightful way. But for those who are Reason fans and Fifth Column fans, you will find much, much of interest in that episode. On the way home, however, I read a short little book called Convenience Store Woman by Sayaka Murata. And it is a really, really interesting treatment of a neurodiverse person who
does just she like trains?
Doesn't yeah, uh huh. But like specifically, she likes her job working in the convenience store in Japan, where she finds kind of order and meaning in her life. There's also an incel shut-in type character in this book. But the book
is this one of the like the Japanese otakus?
Yeah, not quite. There's another word for this specific type of dude who's more incel-y than otaku-y. Like he's a dropout. He's misogynistic. He chooses not to engage in society because society has abandoned him. So it's angrier, I think, than an otaku. But The book is resolutely neutral on the question of whether actually consumerist capitalism giving this person a way of being in the world is bad or good. And it is fascinating. It sort of gives you this like fluorescent lit Emily Dickinson vibe. Like, it's, is it dark or is it actually inspiring? We don't know. I really recommend it, especially if you are thinking some thoughts about, you know, what to do with people who don't fit in to society. How do we think about how to do the right thing by people who are misfits? And this book is I think it is the 10th book by the author, but the first translated into English. It was kind of a big deal when it first dropped in about 2018. I am very late to it, but I really, really recommend it. And it's short.
Speaking of capitalism.
I was really hoping you were going to go with neurodiversity.
No.
Or Frenchy Fuqua, of course.
Also not quite that either. I went and I'll give Nick Gillespie one guess because it would go too long. I went and rewatched a comedy from the 1980s for the first time since the 1980s. What was it, Nick?
Burglar with Whoopi Goldberg.
Wow. I want to know what crawled in your brain and died. Mm-hmm. It's really good. Okay. No, I watched... Trading Places, the second.
Oh, yeah. I watched that not too long ago. Yeah.
The second big Eddie Murphy movie after 48 hours. Mm-hmm. And I'm here to tell you people, go watch it again. It's so good. Yeah. It's really, really funny. And like it's impossible not to watch it and just start checking off the boxes of things that you're not going to see anymore in a movie. Not just Dan Aykroyd's blackface. Mm-hmm. That happens. We got Hooker with a Heart of Gold character, gratuitous Jamie Lee Curtis boobs, a raping gorilla joke towards the end. It's just spectacular.
That's the one bad note in the movie, I think.
I'm not sure that there are any great just very, very funny. A very nice Philadelphia movie. There should always be more Philadelphia movies. I think we can all agree. And there's also a fun thing. This is made in 1983. John Landis picture. There's the raping gorilla is being unloaded onto a container ship in what is now Brooklyn Bridge Park. Like, stuff's changed since 1983, it seems. And
that's a tremendous movie about nature versus nurture, of course. It's all structured as a bet between, like, I don't know, Charles Murray and Robert Putnam, if they were billionaire commodity trading brothers. It's very good.
It's very good. When looking at the Wikipedia page for it, at the bottom, this great line here that just sort of tells us about the times that we live in. In response to the 2020 George Floyd protests about racial inequality, Trading Places was one of 16 films that had a disclaimer added by the British broadcaster Sky UK. The disclaimer read, "This film has outdated attitudes, language, and cultural depictions, which may cause offense with a C today." If that isn't an advertisement for a comedy, I don't really know what is. That's all the inappropriate comedy we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Listen to all of our podcasts, please, at reason.com/podcasts or reason.com/podcast. I'm excited. I know Nick is excited, and Catherine and Peter are excited from afar, from a Acela train distance afar, because tonight on the Soho Forum, Gene Epstein, there's going to be a cage mm-hmm. match between anti-war stalwart Scott Horton and Bill Kristol. Yeah. Oh, man. They're going to be talking about American foreign policy and war and all that good stuff.
This is Frazier and Ali.
Ali Umboye.
On the MSA.
Horton,
you mean
Umboye.
Frazier Crane, though?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, that would be nice. Yeah.
No, that should be great, and that'll be coming to your earballs soon enough. And if you have any chance to catch a ticket, find it. Although I think it's all been sold out for a while. But anyways, we'll catch you otherwise next week, and goodbye.